Well, good morning, everyone. It is my great pleasure to introduce the first speaker for today, Anjum Rahman. Anjum is well known in Hamilton. She's a much respected person in Hamilton. She stood for the Hamilton City Council in the last election, and although she didn't get in, she polled very well, and that's no wonder because she is committed to social things. Social justice. She has been the founding member of SHAMA, the Hamilton Ethnic Women's Centre, an organisation that provides social support to women from ethnic minority communities. She's a long-time member of the Waikato Interfaith Council and takes active part in interfaith activities. She is a founding member of the Islamic Women's Council and has done a lot of media work in recent years on issues of relevance to Muslim women. Anjum is a very articulate person, and I have a great respect for her, and a lot of people have. And you're in for a real treat this morning. I ask you to warmly welcome her as a friend of the Sea of Faith in Hamilton.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Naomai, Hairamai, Itene Po, Ena Mana, Ena Reo, Ena Iwi, Ena Hawefa, Tena Koto, Tena Koto, Tena Koto Katoa. Yes, I'm not the sort of person who does like prepared speeches. I prefer to have more notes and go with the flow. So I may go off my prepared speech a little bit, but hopefully not too much because I don't want to put out the organisers. So, first of all, I want to thank you all for inviting me to speak at this conference, and I really appreciate it, and they've been very kind and hospitable. As I did my PowerPoint presentation, I discovered a thing called the snipping tool, and I was just explaining that I'm pretty technologically incompetent, but I love the snipping tool. I think it's the best thing since the dishwasher, and I think the dishwasher inventor is going straight to heaven. But yes, so I've done lots of snipping and pasting on this slide. But, you know, when I look at the keynote speakers, that's what I feel like. I've sort of moved through the Twilight Zone into Sesame Street. And as you can see, I don't know if many of you remember or watched a lot of Sesame Street, but they used to have that thing where three of these things are all like the other. And so if you want to play the game, I'm trying to see if you can guess which one of these things is not like the other one. you know, diversity is an increasing feature of New Zealand society, and it's an increasing feature of Western society. So I'll try these slides. Hopefully you can read some of it, but we'll just go through it quickly. So it's just giving some migration figures, and this is Africa, which sees 15% of the world's population, but very few international migrants into that continent. and 2.8 million are refugees just fleeing other countries. Whereas if you look at United States and Canada, while they're 5% of the world's population, they have 20% of the world's migrants. And there's similar figures for Europe, about 10% of the world's population, but a quarter. Whereas Asia, which has 60% of the world's population, only 30% of migrants. So, which is still a lot of people, but you know, comparatively. And, of course, us down at the bottom corner of the world. And as it says, over 25% of residents were born outside of the region in Australasia. But I thought this graph that I got from a UN report sort of shows it more visually and clearly. So the dark green is where there is a lot of migrants, and the yellow is where there are very few. And you can tell that mostly the migration is happening towards Western countries. please. Don't want to go too much off script. And we can see, you know, we can interpret what's happening from this migration pattern. And it's quite clear that people are trying to escape poverty and corruption. And they're seeking a better life for themselves and their children and moving into areas where they think that there's more development and wealth. And for the countries that have the migrants, these migrants often are a source of cheap labour. And for us in New Zealand, that source of cheap labour tends to be from the Pacific Islands and Asia. And we import workers to work in areas like the aged care sector, the agricultural sector, the Christchurch rebuild. And often you find that these are the paid workers that are the most vulnerable and the worst paid. And, of course, these poorer countries are a source of talent for us, because, of course, we design our immigration laws so that we take the best and we keep out the poor, those that are deemed unsuccessful or going to be a potential drain on us and our economy. Unless, of course, it's these cheap labour-type workers who we keep here on temporary visas. And we're now seeing in the aged care sector that people that are on work visas for over 10 years... You know, and if they're good enough to be working at a place for 10 years, you would think they were good enough to get permanent residence. But by keeping them on work permits, you keep them much more vulnerable and much more frightened to complain about malpractice or low pay. But because we're sort of trying to take the best, you know, you have to think about whether this is actually exacerbating the divide that we already see between the countries that have more and the countries that have less. And we also see within poorer countries what we call cultural imperialism. Oh, sorry, let me go there. Yes. And in developing countries, we often also see exploitation of resources and labour through a mixture of what we call foreign investment and corruption. And I thought the chocolate industry is one that is just a good example, but it's happening in a lot of industries that we know of. You know, what is happening in the chocolate industry is all these big companies that we know of, Nestle, Hershey's, they buy the cocoa beans in bulk, and it's all brought to warehouses, and it's all mixed up, and so they can't tell when they purchase which of the beans are from the countries where slave labour is practiced and which are the ones that aren't. And this is a sort of deniable plausibility sort of argument for them that they don't know. But, I mean, this all did come out in around 2003, 2004, about the appalling child slave labour that is happening, particularly on the west coast of Africa. And it's been through all the media. Everyone knows about it, you know, or should know about it. And yet, you know, despite knowing about it, and despite knowing that these companies are complicit in it and they structured it in a way that they don't have to be seen to be doing anything about it or actually do anything about it, we're still buying heaps of chocolate off the shelves out of our supermarkets and in doing so, allowing this practice to continue. And I just want to put in a plug for one of my favourite filmmakers, Kumkum Bhavni, who's done a film called Nothing Like Chocolate. It's a documentary film. And I really recommend, if you get the time and the chance, to have a look at that. So, yes, back to cultural imperialism. yes, we see that happening in developing countries because access to wealth means that you have access to media and the ability to influence media. And we know that people in developed countries have often the leisure, the access to technology, the opportunity to create media, a lot more. And for the last few decades, people in developing countries have been absorbing the cultural norms and the patterns of developed countries. They hear the music, they see the stories, and they absorb the latest trends. And while we don't go anywhere near the same of absorbing what's coming from them, and then even when we tell what are their stories, you know, we filter it through our own sort of cultural lens. But there is a change, and that's particularly through social media. And we saw in the last Gaza war that we could see pictures, and you know, on the ground reports directly through Twitter of the devastation that was caused. And it wasn't the censored version that we were used to getting from mainstream media, but direct, pretty brutal pictures. You know, and they were coming up on your screen as the attacks were happening. And this is, you know, social media can be a very negative tool, but it also can be a very positive one. And we had similar things happening with the Arab Spring, and that the global audiences were getting stories straight from the source, straight from the people that were there. And they no longer needed to rely on a mainstream media filter and having that media decide which are the stories that should be told, which information is to be given out and which is to be ignored, what is to be highlighted. So, you know, I think that it's really a good thing because it allows us to identify with people that we normally don't get to see or hear from a lot in our media. And it's happening right now with the refugee crisis in Europe. So we know that the situation in Syria has been critical for at least 4 years. The UN has been making loud noises and you know, asking for aid and saying that there's a huge crisis. But finally, you know, when the reports of people fleeing and drowning and dying in the backs of trucks and creating this huge crisis in Europe, once that has happened, we're finally seeing some kind of global reaction and a response for these people. As it is, we don't do diversity well, I think. And, you know, that, you know, at the highest levels of decision making, and this is just one aspect of diversity, which is gender, you know, we just don't have that diversity at the highest levels of decision making power. And some people still cling to the myth that it's a level playing field, you know, and that if there's certain demographics don't get through, well, it's because they're not good enough, clearly. You know, everyone has the same chance. It's just they just must be not good enough, not smart enough, not hardworking enough, too lazy. And, you know, there is amongst a large section of society a refusal to recognise that the system is gamed, that often the decisions as to who gets up and moves up these levels is based on networks. It's based on who you know. It's based on shoulder tapping. It's based on a certain value base that recognises certain skills and not other skills. And so as a value base, for example, we don't recognise mothering skills in the business world. So you could have spent 20 years raising 4 or 5 children who are incredibly successful and apply for a job, and you can't put that on your CV. And I mean, you could put it on, but it won't count because it's through the value base that we have and the people that are making those decisions. They're not treating that as skills that would be relevant to their job, when very often I think they would be relevant. And then the system is gamed, of course, with internal prejudices, you know, and our own fears. Fears of people with different accents, and will people understand them, or they might do things that we're not sure if they'll fit in or they'll be happy here. All of those things tend to game the system, and so that it isn't really a level playing field. And we still don't do well at recognising that the makeup of our country has changed and that we have to do things differently, or at least accept that other people do things differently and that our structures and institutions don't often serve those people well. And we continue to not recognise that, even though we've had decades of statistics in health and education and the justice sector that show that minority groups are not doing very well at all in the way that we've currently structured our society. And I don't know, these probably are a bit small to read, but that's life expectancy. And as you can see, the Maori and Pacific are quite a lot lower. This is the prison population, ethnicity of prisoners, and it's chopped off the bottom there, but that big group is, of course, Māori. This one, unemployment rates. So the Europeans sort of down here, and the rest, Māori, Asian, European, are a lot higher than that. And this is the only one where the Asians do really well. We're at the top here, which is, you know, getting school qualifications. But the other groups are floundering down the bottom. So we know this, and we've known it for a long, long time. And I guess, you know, we can comfort ourselves with the fact that other countries do it a lot worse. And that includes both developing and developed countries. And for developed countries, developing countries, you know, you're dealing with some really high levels of sectarian violence and death. And a lot of that violence is drummed up by political aspirants because for some reason it always works. It just always works that you pick a particular little minority target group and blame all the ills of society on them. A minority that you know is pretty powerless and not able to affect the outcome for you. And it really has worked a lot. And in that regard, I'd recommend a book called Votes and Violence. And I've just forgotten what the author's name is. It's Stephen someone. But Google that. And he's done a really very interesting piece of work studying in India the states and their representation and their need for minority governments. And he shows quite clearly that where state governments have required a minority group to get the majority and be in power, there is a lot less sectarian violence and a lot less death than in states where they don't need minority groups. So the thing is that at a global level, it's really important that we learn to do diversity a lot better. I mean, we cannot afford this kind of divisiveness. And who do such divisions profit? Who do they serve? This is some of the latest data on military expenditure. So the arms industry is actually the biggest industry in the world. It beats out the illegal drug trade. And that's, you know, US billions, and that's the levels we're talking about there. Also, you know, multinational corporations, the oil industries, richer countries, or at least the elites within richer countries, are all benefiting from keeping us all divided and hating each other. Right, so these are the realities of climate change, and I'm going to assume that you all know, you know, the basic topic, and I don't need to tell you about that. But we know that, you know, we're going to have rising sea levels, more drought, meaning less food, more hurricanes and extreme weather events. The poor will get poorer because in those extremes... Sorry? It's gone off. Oh, dear. We'll have to go to Plan B. We'll go to this one. Just excuse me a moment. Excellent. I love technology, even though I'm bad at it. yes. So, what happens, as I said, the poor will get poorer, because when you have these extreme weather events and so on, you know, they tend to suffer more and die more because they can't afford those well-structured, earthquake-proof buildings. And so you see that an event that was catastrophic for us, had it happened, you know, that Christchurch earthquake at the same level in a developing country, we would have been talking about thousands of deaths. Thank you. So, and similarly, we see it with hurricanes and floodings, where in New Zealand it's rare that someone will die. We do see damage. Countries like Samoa and Tonga will see many deaths and a lot more devastation because these structures are so much more temporary and not as strong. So we already live in a world where there is overuse and depletion of natural resources, depletion of the fishing stock. We already create way too much rubbish, and especially the not harmful, non-biodegradable kind. We already know that the way we're living is unsustainable, and we know that it's causing problems with the climate. And as climate changes, the impacts of our current lifestyle, we know, are going to be a lot worse. And the irony is that we have enough food to feed everyone in the world. And yet we allow 3.1 million children a year to die of poor nutrition. That's 21,000 a day. And I was thinking that I might try and get an internet connection and put this website up so that you could see it. What it does is it puts up the names and the faces of the people that are dying, and it just ticks over. And again, it's something that I'd recommend that you do, just as a thing. And just think about each of these faces and each of these names, and knowing that each one of those people is someone that is loved, someone that is treasured, and that their death is a tragedy for somebody or a group of somebodies. And also look at the colours and the countries that they're coming from, because to me that matters as well. And the fact that they're dying, it's our choice, right? It's our choice in the way that we structure the world and the governments we elect, in our purchasing choices, in the media we choose to watch, in the clicks we make on the computer, the words we write in our social media spaces. And just as an aside, actually, if any of you haven't listened to Manuka Lewinsky's TED Talk, which I think she did either early this year or last year, I really recommend it. And one of the things that she talks about is clicking with compassion. And she talks about her experience and being on suicide watch and the way that there were so many corporations that actually and that do profit out of the misery and devastation that is caused to individual people's lives. And the way that she lays it out is really good. And so she talks, as I said, about clicking with compassion. And I think that that is, you know, we often don't think that it's just a simple thing of what we look at and what we click at and what we see on media, but it's all being recorded and it all makes a difference. And the other side of the appalling poverty, of course, is the immense wealth of some individuals. And as I said, it suits their interests for all of us to be hating each other. It suits their interests to create this divide and the suspicion of the other. And it suits their interests for us to think that our differences are insurmountable. My contention is that it's time to move beyond these divisions to the realities of commonality. And it's imperative that we do so. And in doing so, that we build a movement for change. There's no doubt that the groups that we're fighting are incredibly powerful. And you saw, you know, with the military graph how much money they have. They're incredibly well-financed. They're incredibly well-organized. And there isn't any doubt at all that the kind of changes that we're wanting to make are quite considerable and will be unpopular. If for no other reason that humans are, you know, resistant to change as it is. And if you don't believe me, just Google the words change management, and you probably can't see it, but that's 310 million results. It's a whole field of study. I've studied management, and we had, you know, whole courses on change management. But also, you know, it's not just that we have an innate resistance to change, but it's that the changes that we're asking people to make are actually, you know, potentially going to make us worse off. They might make our lives a little less comfortable, a little less convenient. The Cassandra view of the world, and one that the global elites desperately want us to believe, is that it can't be done. It's in their interest that we feel powerless and fail to act. It's best if we keep busy trying to make a living, or are distracted with the latest fashions and consumer goods, with celebrity gossip, with weight loss strategies. Yeah, try being a woman on the internet and see if it doesn't keep popping up those weight loss ads. So that's why I don't put gender on any of my social media. But it's best for them. if the most powerful media organisations don't provide in-depth analysis of policies and problems. And it's hard not to feel a strong sense of despair when we see the headlines in the tabloid papers, when we see the unbalanced commentary, the lack of ability to hold power to account. We feel powerless when, after so many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people around the world protested against the invasion of Iraq, that invasion and occupation, that destruction still went ahead. And it's hard not to feel frustrated and angry as we watch those leaders who lied to us about weapons of mass destruction that never existed escape any kind of accountability. And the awful fruits of their work is being witnessed in that region today. It's gutting to watch the extreme violence, the videos of beheadings, the erosion of basic rights, while the only response from other governments, including our own, seems to be, let's just bomb them some more. That'll work. Apparently it was Rita Mae Brown who wrote the definition of insanity. That's fine. Oops. So the easy path, and I'm sorry to inflict Mrs. Thatcher on you this early in the morning, but, you know, the easy path is one that chooses to accept that there is no alternative. And it allows us to continue living in our comfortable lives, at least those of us who can afford to do so, and those of us who are able to still come under that definition of what we call the middle class. But I refuse to accept that defeatist argument. All sense of decency, humanity, empathy, and everything that is good about human nature screams against such a fatalistic complacency. To me, the Cassandra option is a dereliction of our own duty to our fellow human beings, to our future generations, and ultimately to ourselves. I think that losing hope is one of the biggest failures of a human being. I know what it's like to lose hope on a personal level, and it's very much a first step towards losing the will to live. Very often we lose hope because of the circumstances we find ourselves in, some of which may be our own fault, and some of which we maybe have no control over at all. For me, it's faith that sustains me, the certain knowledge that there is a God who watches our efforts and allows nothing to go to waste, the knowledge that we might never see the positive results from our efforts towards better things, but that God is there, watching us and rewarding our struggle. For it is the struggle that matters more than the end result. For me, the essence of faith is hope. Faith sustains hope and so encourages us to be better, to keep trying even though we make mistakes and behave badly or negligently. Faith is about being weak and being forgiven. It's about picking yourself back up and trying again. So let's not give in to the Cassandra type fatalism and predictions of certain doom. And neither is it acceptable to sit back and wait for change. Wait for someone else to take up the burden, because the responsibility is ours. It is ours, each and every one of us, individually and collectively. So let's work as if we can make a difference, because if we do that, we might just succeed. And if we don't succeed, at least we know we did our best. I find hope in social media and the way that we can connect to each other via various technological advances. I find hope in the various ways that we are able to bypass tyranny and control. I find hope in the fact that the most fearsome of tyrants have been overthrown by their own people. I find hope in the everyday kindness that I see human beings showing to each other. I find hope in all the young people I see who are educated and aware and who come together to push for change. I find hope in smiles and hugs and even in tears. I find hope in the fact that we're all present here, together, at this time, on this day, caring about each other and about our fate. I think humanity is worth fighting for, and this planet and the life on it are worth fighting for. So, successful movements are built on common values and common goals. What we need is a global movement, which means a global set of values, or a global culture, if you will. So what would a global culture look like? What are the things that matter? On the day that I had to submit this speech, it was also the day that the government had put as a date for submissions on a project they call a legislative response to family violence. And one of the questions, there was like 40 questions, it was a horrendous thing, but one of the questions was, how would guiding principles affect how the Domestic Violence Act and other legislation is implemented? What principles would you suggest? And I thought that some of the principles that I put down in my submission there are, you know, maybe a place to start. So, you know, thinking I wrote these in the context, I'm also working these days part-time as strategic manager of the Hamilton Ethnic Women's Centre, and I thought, you know, we all deserve to be able to live in dignity and to have ourselves, our person and our mana respected. We all have the right to have a say in our lives and in things that affect us. We should be able to leave relationships that don't work for us. And that when we're trying to improve situations for people, that we actually should be taking into account their cultural background, their religious background, the way they think and feel, and the things that they value. And that solutions must make the situation better and not worse. And I'll give you an example. You think, well, of course, that's so obvious, but it isn't always. One of the rules that CIFS has, Child, Youth and Family, is we know, the research is quite conclusive on this point, we know that children that grow up in an atmosphere of violence are likely to perpetrate violence, or certainly they will also be damaged by that violence. And therefore, when it comes to their attention that a woman or you know someone in the family is the victim of violence, they require her to actually leave her husband or partner. They require her to leave, and if she doesn't, then they'll take the children away. And what we're finding in ethnic communities is the impact of that is that they just don't report violence. And so the outcome of that policy is that the children are still living in a violent situation, but that situation doesn't improve because they're not reporting it. So you're actually having an adverse outcome from a solution that you might think was on the face of it, well, yes, of course, this is what we should be doing because we know it's bad for the kids. The other place that we could look is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in terms of looking for that global culture. And as someone who's been trained as a human rights facilitator, that definitely does appeal to me. But even if we don't take all the articles and just stick to a few, we can make progress. Concepts such as justice, self-determination, inclusion, removal of poverty. A global culture is one where we learn how to deal with disagreement. And one of my favourite books on this topic is called Adab Ikhtilaf, or The Etiquettes or Ethics of Disagreement. And unfortunately, I got the author wrong, so when you get the printed version, this is the correct author, Tabar Jabir Al-Alwani. And he deals with this issue. This book is actually about early Islamic history, and he goes through various scholars and how they disagreed with each other and how they spoke about each other when they had differing opinions. And invariably, the most learned of scholars would never put another scholar down. They would never say, oh, he's stupid, he's ignorant, or he's just, you know, he's wrong. They'd say, you know, I really respect that person. They're a wonderful person. He's come to a different conclusion than me. Maybe he's seen material I haven't. This is my opinion from the best of my knowledge, and if he has a different one, then that is his opinion, and he should be respected as a person. And that is how they actually dealt with difference and disagreement. And sometimes they were disagreeing on some very fundamental religious issues. And I think those examples are actually universally applicable. And learning skills around negotiation and mediation, for me, it should be as compulsory a subject in our schools as maths and writing and reading. I mean, these are basic human skills and they have to be learnt. We're not just innately born with them. But again, that comes back to our cultural values and where they are and what we're placing as being important. So that is at least part of my vision of a global culture, and I suspect that it's probably going to be quite similar to yours. I've heard of, but I can never find, I haven't found it anywhere on the internet, but I've heard that the United Nations once did some kind of research and found that all the major religions of the world had about 200 common values. So there is actually a lot more that unites us. The problem we have is, to me, is not so much in determining what our common values should be. I mean, our predecessors managed to come up with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and get, you know, agreement around it. The problem, of course, is in enforcing them, and in a way that's beneficial rather than harmful. And that, to me, is where the biggest challenge lies. This is where we desperately need leadership and guidance. The most powerful tools that we have in this struggle are education, persuasion, critical thinking, and patience. But greater than all of those is faith, the strong belief that we can make a difference. So where do we start? I think we start with organisation and with making connections. We do the opposite of what the warmongers do. We support and get behind those who are already successful in making the changes we want to see. We build networks and publicise, or in evangelical terms, we spread the word. And we already know that the efforts of past generations and even the efforts that we've made in our own lifetimes are bearing fruit. Research by Steven Pinker shows that the world is actually becoming less violent. And this graph starts after World War II. So you can imagine that the numbers would have been way higher preceding into that. And he's written a subsequent thing to this book to say that, you know, by 2014 violence has escalated, but even then, and he goes back, if you read more of the research, to previous centuries and the way that we punished, the fact that domestic violence was not even a thing, that it was acceptable to be hitting and beating your wife and kids, and so on. That actually things aren't, you know, I think it is him, that says that it's because the media now are so focused on reporting court cases and reporting every incident of violence that we have this internal feeling that the world is very violent. But in a global sense, it isn't, and that the trends are going down. We also know that producers and retailers do respond to pressures from consumers and that they've made changes to move towards more environmentally sustainable methods and products as a result of changing attitudes. Volkswagen aside, I mean, they made the attempt, they just did it illegally. So we know that the more that we push for solutions, the more likely it is that research and development budgets will go towards the solutions that we need. The proof is there that we can make a difference, and we know how to do it. So there's no excuse for giving up or being complacent. Let's keep moving forward. Thank you.
Before I express our thanks to Anjan, we have time for a couple of brief questions, if anybody would like to put these to Anjan. Would you please stand so we can bring the mic to you?
Just a very brief one. What was the name of the person who... you were quoting just at the end there.
Steven Pinker, I think his name was. Yep. That's with a V, Stephen with a V.
Yes, thank you very much for your talk. You did mention the role of the mainstream media. How would you reflect on the current trend of the mainstream media in New Zealand currently?
It's really unfortunate. I think that the model isn't working. So we're seeing all the good investigative journalists being laid off. You probably will all have heard of who the Herald has let go in the last 5 to 6 weeks, including Dita Damoni. But in the last week or two, they've got a big list of people. Fairfax saying that they're not going to have cartoonists anymore, maybe just have one, which again, and sometimes we find the biggest and most poignant dissent is through political cartoons. So I think that the problem that we're having because of the internet is that the money is not reaching media organisations. They're cutting back. I know that, and I've been to visit the editor of the Waikato Times a couple of years ago on a complaint, and he said, we're lucky some days to have two people in the newsroom trying to get out a paper. So it's those pressures. It's political pressures, advertising pressures that are causing dissent to go. To me, the loss of Campbell Live was a huge deal, and I think it's had a huge effect. And the impact on zero-hour contracts is currently visible. Now that he's gone, they've brought it back, and it's terrible. But I hope you'll be listening to... I listened to one of his podcasts that he's been putting up recently. They're really good. One area that I think is really good is, I don't know if you know about Scoop. Some of you will know about Scoop. They're setting up a foundation. I find, and I used their website a lot, because at least they're honest. They just put out the press releases. They don't try and pick it up as journalism, and you get the press releases from all sides, and you can read it up, and they have some really good opinion pieces, and they're looking at a sustainable model. So I've personally donated to them, and I think that is sort of the way to go. And the thing is, as I said as well, is social media, just finding the places and clicking, on the things that you think are worth reading and will make a difference, and staying away from... I never click on an entertainment story. I just don't. I'm not into celebrity culture. I don't care who's with who or who said what or who smoked at their concert. Don't care. Not important. Yeah.
Last question.
There has been, over the last few weeks, the finalised set of sustainable development goals, 17 of them, which include things like eliminating all forms of poverty everywhere, gender equality, increased equality within and among nations. There's a whole range of them. I'm just wondering, do you think this is a movement towards a common set of values?
Yes, I think it is. Actually, I have a close friend who got sponsored by the United States Embassy to go to, and she's in New York at the moment, and part of all of that stuff that's happening there. So I think that it is, but as I said, it's not so much developing the values that are the issue, because these are things, the CEDAW and so on, they've been there for years and years, and we're requiring people to report on these things. And just last year, Judith Collins went to Geneva, and I know this because I have another friend who also went to Geneva, when the International Human Rights Council required New Zealand to report on its progress on human rights issues. So we're required to report. I think the CEDAW report, which, if you're not aware of it, is the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, all forms of discrimination against women, and they require us to report every 5 years. And so next year we'll go back and the NGO sector will report. So all of those sort of mechanisms are in place, but the thing is, are they making a difference, and how can we make them more effective, and how can we make our governments more accountable? Because if we actually got publicity in terms of what is being presented, and there's very few organisations, unless you're linked in with NCW, for example, or a couple of other women's organisations, I think Pacific Women's Watch in Auckland, you don't hear about it. You don't know about it. You have no idea what someone went and said, right? So that's where I think for us trying to hold our governments accountable for those reports, for what they're saying, for what they have promised to do subsequently to improve the situation is where we can be most effective.
And Jen, I don't know whether you've read the paper that we had from Lloyd yesterday, but this has been such a fitting and practical sequel to what we heard yesterday. Everybody here is, I'm sure, very committed to the fact that we all want to be part of the change, the urgent change that must happen. But you have addressed the question, the big question that hovers over our whole conference: what can we do? What can I do? What must our country do? So thank you for the way that you've given such an insightful and fascinating overview of how things are with respect to diversity, divisiveness, where we're currently up to, but most of all, for the way that you've brought such hope and passion and conviction in addressing the questions, what can we all do? And coming from Hamilton myself, I've seen what Anjan has done and the way that she challenges at every opportunity, at every level. No one gets away with anything, that you refuse to be tied to just speaking for migrants, as a lot of people try to put you in that category. But within our own migrant community, that you've done as much in challenging the old conservative Hamiltonian about going beyond the responsibility for their own household. We've had open days at mosques, intercultural exchange. You've moved in whenever you have the chance. And I know that you are a wonderful role model and a catalyst to the values that we're here and all of us want to embrace more of. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for the challenges that you've brought to us today. Thank you.